morning. My name is Michael McCusker. On November 13, 1953, Mrs. Thomas J. White of the Indiana Textbook Commission called for the removal of Robin Hood's name from state school books because, she said, he robbed from the rich and gave it to the poor. That's the communist line, she said. She also attacked Quakers for their pacifism. Michael Khodorkovsky, a professor of history at Loyola University in Chicago, wrote in the New York Times 2 days ago, January 22nd, Vladimir Putin's regime is desperately searching for an ideology in the dark corner of Russian history and theology. The fact that this ideology depends on creating a nationalist and anti-Western rhetoric alongside a vision of an Orthodox Christian Holy Russia should give anyone pause for serious concern. Joseph Stalin did the same during World War II in the epic struggle to save the communist state by wrapping the battle for survival against Nazism in the mantle of Holy Mother Russia. I wrote a manifesto about Russian communism with which I start today's program. I kind of call it the God that suicided. 30 years ago this year, in 1989, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics began to noticeably unravel, in particular its outer rings of so-called independent republics in Eastern Europe and later in the Baltic states and Georgia, which demanded independence, which precipitated the collapse of its center in Moscow in 1991, 1 year before its platinum anniversary. The Big Red Star, once hoped to be the essential revolution of the masses against the long history of tyranny and oppression, in particular the dreadful centuries of brutish feudal serfdom in Russia that ended elsewhere among humanity half a millennium earlier, collapsed into bitter splinters of ancient hatreds as around the world communism was simultaneously rejected as a successor to colonialism and as the structure and ideology of newly enfranchised governments in the Third World. Instead of seizing the future and proclaiming the new man, and that's a quote, through world revolution, communism swiftly diminished as a relic of the past, swept, it might be said, into the dustbin of history, the god that failed, simultaneous with its astonishing suicide. The triumph of Bolshevik communism over its rivals after the fall of the Romanov Tsars in 1917 quickly devolved into a monstrously rigid, cruel, and eventually stagnant system that, particularly under Stalinism, murdered millions of its citizens and imprisoned millions more in a massive, inquisitory system of Siberian gulags. Ultimately, the Soviet state, despite its immense expansion following World War II, in which at least 20 million Russians died in truly mortal combat with Nazi Germany, and probably as a result of the cause and effect that inimical duality, fell, imploded from the mendacious inertia of its own doctrinaire historical materialism. A purported socialist millennium seemed to have ended abruptly after only 75 years, which was at least a half century longer than its mortal enemy, Hitler's 1,000-year Reich, which lasted only a dozen years. World communism and its broken pledge of universal suffrage had its beginning in downtrodden Russia in 1917, which instigated its promise and its imperceptible failure. That which would liberate the masses but instead became their most pervasively cruel and genocidal enslavement had once been hoped to be the essential revolution of chattel humanity against, as Abraham Cowley wrote, all the ills that men and women endure. The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in 1848 summed up communist theory in a single sentence, abolition of private property, and claimed that political power is merely the organized power of one class for oppressing another. Marx thought a political system could be managed to avoid despotic excesses, that collective will was simply enough because it was his vision as historically ordained, thus unnecessary for people's rights to be written into law, a bitter trap his 19th century vision set for 20th century proletarians who were forced to succumb to unconscionable repression in the happy doublethink of a people's dictatorship. Marx, the quintessential architect of the communist theory, spoke about the inevitability of history as if it is a primary motivation that by its own iron necessity progresses toward the disintegration of nations and the obliteration of the rich and powerful, resulting in the triumph of the wage earner. The closer one-party state communism came to its goal of world revolution, the less recognizable it was from its original idea of universal liberation, until at last its gross contradictions exposed a fatal rottenness throughout. The subsequent failure of Soviet communism through its own tenets prescribed by Marx and Engels and by V.I. Lenin, who twisted their ideal into a massively ruthless culture of state autocracy comparable to the Nazism that grew up alongside as a more deviantly younger sibling further to the West, not only exposed the contradictions of Marxism, but enlarged upon them, claiming justification by the tenets themselves. Lenin, whose Bolshevik Party usurped every other involved in the Russian Revolution of 1917, thought that czarist royalty, bankers, and businessmen who were the owners of capital also owned every other part of the state, and he was certain that liberation of the appeased classes was impossible without violent revolution, without destruction, so to speak, of the apparatus of the state. American democracy, which was also born from violent revolution, was constructed by its framers who recognized the dangers of an all-powerful and unchecked government, and despite its own contradictions and corruptions, developed a balance of powers within its governing institutions and a written constitution and bill of rights for its ordinary citizenry. Imperfect as the balance has proven to be, it has consequently not easily or legally been trampled upon, though of course powerful politicians and would-be autocrats, especially among the wealthier tiers of American society, have continually attempted to commandeer nearly total power, with or without party support, just as the founders expected. Although Marx, Lenin, and their proletarian communism are considered as history's failures, many Americans believe that democracy was not merely doomed during the Great Depression of the 1930s, but that it did not deserve to survive because it had failed its people and was unworthy of preservation and should be unequivocally eradicated. Capitalists were under attack for blatantly causing the Depression as a result of their reckless, untrammeled greed. Their capitalist monetary policies were repudiated. Their voracious avarice and criminal corruption were held primarily responsible for the ruin of American society. Bankers and businessmen were made as guilty of crimes against the nation in the 1930s as the backlash retaliatory 1950s were to despise domestic Marxist communism and communists, many of whom had been party members during the Depression and upon whom fell revenge 20 years later for advocating the end of capitalism. Paradoxically, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a true American blue blood, who was denigrated as a socialist and traitor to his class by paragons of wealth and property, sought to save Americanized capitalism by applying basic democratic reforms of economic and social justice, as well as civil and political freedoms his enemies called communist and socialist, to save democracy in the USA. World War II, to add irony to paradox, saved and fantastically enriched the American economy. And as it turned out, both the USA and USSR emerged from World War II as the world's preeminent superpowers, destined to be top of the dunghill opponents for most of the last half of the 20th century. Their competition was focused around an immensely expensive and human extinction-threatening nuclear arms race in a Cold War that lasted nearly 50 years. A newspaper cartoon about that time, if not of that time, by Huck Konopacki, pictured three men chained to heavy symbols of the period on their backs. one of the Nazi swastika, another the hammer and sickle that represented communism, and the third burdened by the Yankee sign of the dollar, who says to the others, "What a coincidence. Mine is a symbol of working class liberation, too." A caustic Cold War joke expressed the patent hypocrisy of the dueling dualistic hysteria. Under communism, man oppresses man. Under capitalism, just the other way around. From the end of World War II until the USSR exploded its first test of atomic power in 1949, Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin expropriated his Red Army's liberation of Eastern Europe from Nazi conquest during the war into the burgeoning communist empire that was abruptly locked behind what Winston Churchill, in his formidable eloquence, called the Iron Curtain. George Orwell, author of the prophetic visionary novel of a totalitarian future, 1984, gave the name Cold War to the incipient nuclear arms race between the USA and USSR. Stalin's post-war totalitarian socialist empire was the antithesis of Marxist ideology, but was an extensive contagion of Leninism. Marx, someone said, idealized human behavior too much, which caused disaster in most socialist regimes. He ignored certain characteristics, such as the desire for acquisition, which is recognized in even young children and defies the best intentions of every theology and ideology, in particular the avaricious grasping for power and privilege. Other not quite salutary traits include stolid passivity by many toward power and authority, mental torpor at all levels of society, and more understandably, the desperate will to survive even the most awful circumstances by outward submission and shirking anonymity. Communism is as ancient as democracy, and one crude form or another of each has been at least considered, if seldom practiced, since tribal and communal prehistory. Ever more complex in their theories and cultural adaptions as the problems of expanding civilization magnified, primarily aristocratic and autocratic tyranny, the third leg of human governance. Democratic dialectics were preoccupied essentially with legal rights, the relations between rulers and ruled, while communistic or socialistic hypotheses evolved around people's communal relationships with production and capital. Communist ideas were particularly potent in the United States during the late 19th century and early 20th century, and the Great Depression of the 1930s. Southern and Eastern European immigrants in particular, and Astoria Finns, turned to socialist and anarchist ethos in reaction to harsh and prejudicial exploitation in mills and factories and in atrocious sweatshops. They had been allowed to immigrate to the U.S. because of the need for mass, cheap labor as a result of the rapid expansion of American industry. American political reaction to communism, long before the Cold War, was harsh and repressive. The savage and persistent persecution against the American labor movement was justified by accusation that the unions were communist-inspired and part of the international communist conspiracy that was determined to destroy the American way of life. Such maledictions of Kremlin infiltration were also declared against the later civil rights movement to support the use of clubs, dogs, and firebombs to keep Jim Crow alive. Similar accusations and methods were used against Vietnam anti-war activists in the 1960s, many of whom did flirt with Marxist, Trotskyite, Maoist, and socialist ideas. The simultaneity of domestic repression during the Cold War was that while the Communist Politburo of the USSR, especially under Stalin, mercilessly purged political parties of any form of free expression, as well as any whiff of capitalist endeavor, the U.S. government reacted against any group that challenged the status quo and lumped all resistance as communist socialism and as enemies of the state. In particular, America suffered severe blows to its democracy with McCarthyism, named after a Wisconsin U.S. senator who was a precursor to the current president, and its purge of nearly every prominent and non-prominent person accused of liberal or leftist beliefs, which paralyzed American society with fear of disfavor, ostracism, and unemployment. The iron fist of Stalinism and the right-wing surge of anti-communist McCarthyism merged to the detriment of both societies and greatly intensified the nuclear threat to both. Walt Whitman, a century and a half ago, wrote, "You Russians and we Americans, our countries so distant, so unlike each other at first glance, such a difference in social and political conditions, and yet in certain features and vastest ones, so resembling each other." Back at the beginning, John Reed, or Oregon's most prominent offering to history, who invented 20th century journalism with his book, 10 Days That Changed the World, an indispensable chronicle of the Bolsheviks' grasp for power in 1917, replied to Western fears and criticisms of the Bolsheviks and the spread of communism in general, which at the time was limited to small parties in a few European countries and the United States. "It is difficult for the foreign bourgeoisie to understand the ideas that moved the Russian masses," Reed said. He had reported from the World War I battlefields and was sickened at the enormous slaughter and carnage, which he considered a class war because the great mass of soldiers killing and dying were from the lower classes. The Russian soldiers were the first to revolt, which inspired the Germans to persuade Lenin to return to Russia from exile and foment revolution and cripple Russia's war effort against Germany, whose leader, the Kaiser, was a cousin of the Tsar, both cousins of the British king. "A new ideology has replaced the attributes of the bourgeois democratic state. There is patriotism. It is all allegiance to the international brotherhood of the working class," Reed said, in belief such a class unity would, among other attributes, put an end to wars. "There is duty to the revolutionary cause," he said. "There is honor based on the dignity of human life and happiness rather on what an aristocracy of blood or wealth has decreed." Reed believed the Russians were inventing a whole new form of civilization, and that's a quote. He was a founder of the American Communist Party, filled with the passionate conviction that the exploited American lower classes, and that again is a quote, finally possessed the instrument to successfully rise up against the reigning plutocracy. John Reed did not live long enough to see the People's Revolution go sour. He died of typhus in 1920 while in Russia and was buried in the Kremlin Wall as a hero of the revolution. Nearly 75 years later, following the collapse of Russian communism, Dr. Nguyen Khắc Vien, who was an early member of the Vietnam Communist Party and later was a leading critic after its victory of a 30-year war against the West, France and the United States specifically, wrote what he said was a pitiless dissection of party degeneration, which Alexander Coburn wrote in The Nation, called an eloquent statement of what should be the aims of a world democratic front. Dr. Vien, whose statement was published in International Viewpoint, criticized the failure of communism in Vietnam and its desperate alliance with foreign capital to save itself. "Democratic liberties must be defended, as must social justice," he said. "It was through a 200-year struggle that the populations of the developed capitalist countries were able to establish a regime of democratic liberties and rights, which should be called proper popular liberties," Dr. Vien wrote. "If a world front of capital is being founded, its counterweight, the democratic popular front on a world scale, is also in formation. The moment will come when the words capitalism and socialism will no longer have any importance. The democratic front will have changed its nature." Dr. Vien, who was 78 when he wrote this statement at the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, concluded, "Freedom of the press, of association, of petition, of demonstration, to strike, and of election are the struggles of our own epoch. They are proven means that can lead to profound reforms." And that was Dr. Nguyen Vien. And after all, as Marx and Engels wrote in their Communist Manifesto, the proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have the world to win. And that was something I wrote, I suppose, as a form of manifesto, The God That Suicided, from the old saying of The God That Failed, if anybody can remember that term. And now, to change subject, but not necessarily, from the New York Times, Roe versus Wade is at risk. Here is how to prepare, and it's written by the New York Times editorial board. Abortion opponents have spent decades planning for a Supreme Court with a majority hostile to reproductive rights. So it's little surprise that, with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh in the fall, the necessary fifth vote, they have been quick to seize the moment. The anti-abortion movement has also spent these decades building a vast fundraising and organizing network with the goals of securing an anti-abortion voting bloc and getting more like-minded judges at every level and lawmakers and presidents into power. Mere weeks after Judge Kavanaugh was sworn in, West Virginia and Alabama passed state constitutional amendments that could ban abortions if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Those on the other side, then, need their own robust and creative playbook, not just to fight back against attacks on reproductive freedom, but also to preemptively protect and expand those freedoms whenever possible. The Supreme Court will determine the fate of Roe, but its dismantling will start on the state level, requiring the effort to push back to be nationwide and expansive. Republican-controlled state legislatures are expected to put forth many pieces of anti-abortion legislation this year. Some are meant to directly challenge Roe versus Wade, like recent proposals in Kentucky and Florida that ban abortion around the sixth week of pregnancy. That can translate to about 2 weeks after a missed menstrual period, before many women even realize that they're pregnant, let alone have time to consider an abortion. Ohio lawmakers have already voted for such a measure. Judges in lower courts, many appointed by President Trump, are expected to uphold more and more extreme anti-abortion laws. So even if the Supreme Court doesn't overturn Roe outright, the lower courts could quietly roll back Americans' constitutional right to the procedure. Women in many parts of the country are already finding it nearly impossible to exercise their reproductive rights. At least 424 anti-abortion bills have been passed at the state level since 2010, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which studies reproductive health. As a result, 43% of all reproductive-age women, 29 million people, now live in areas that are hostile to abortion rights, including seven states that each have just one abortion clinic left. Given this bleak state of affairs, it's all the more important to showcase efforts to support rights on the state level that could serve as models as the fight moves into new legislatures. Lawmakers in states with outdated abortion laws are taking action. Bills in Rhode Island would codify the right to an abortion in the state, no matter what happens to Roe, and would repeal several existing laws that are now unenforceable, like one requiring that a woman receive consent from her husband before getting an abortion, and another that defines life as beginning at conception. Similar legislation will be considered in New Mexico, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Nevada, which recently became the first state in the country with a female majority legislature. While blue states are locking down reproductive rights, tougher fights are breaking out in red and purple states. A lawsuit filed last week in Pennsylvania seeks to overturn the state's ban on using state Medicaid funds to pay for abortion. If successful, it could help thousands more women each year to afford an abortion. This case is evidence of the central inequity around abortion. It is easy for women with means to get an abortion, while poor women are at the mercy of statutes that restrict their rights. That's because only 16 states allow women who rely on Medicaid, in other words, poor women, to use that coverage to pay for an abortion. Such lawsuits can be long shots, but they're shots worth taking, as in Wisconsin, where Planned Parenthood is suing to repeal several anti-abortion laws enacted under the Republican former Governor Scott Walker. Similarly, bills with little chance of passing can still have value. In the deep red bastions of Missouri and Texas, lawmakers like State Representative Jessica Farrar, a Democrat from Houston, have introduced legislation to repeal abortion restrictions and expand access. Such bills may be unlikely to be signed into law, but they raise awareness of an issue that many Americans have long ago tuned out. In these states, these bills can help change the conversation around abortion, said Elizabeth Nash, senior state issues manager at the Guttmacher Institute. In 2017, Representative Farrar also introduced a stunt bill to make a point about the unnecessary restrictions that women face in the state. Among other things, the legislation would have required men to read a booklet about the risks of vasectomies, colonoscopies, and erectile dysfunction drugs before receiving them. There can be a fine line between gimmicks and strategy, but abortion rights supporters have spent too long on the defensive, while anti-abortion forces have put substantial pressure on all three branches of government. It isn't too late to wipe out outdated laws off the books and make the procedure more accessible to low-income women and more available to everyone. And it is certainly high time to make abortion rights a voting issue in elections. The anti-abortion movement understands the high stakes of this moment. Those who support reproductive rights must as well. And that was from the New York Times, by its editorial board, Roe versus Wade is at risk. Here's how to prepare. Well, today is my longtime friend Jimmy Weather's birthday. We got to know each other in Cannon Beach 40-some years ago in the 1970s, both of us relatively recently back from Southeast Asia. He helped construct U.S. air bases in Thailand during the Vietnam War and once had the experience of an elephant haul his big caterpillar tractor out of a river. He was creatively influenced when he was very young by a notebook of a highly skilled and enterprising carpenter of all trades, who often invented his own tools to do a job. Mr. Weathers has done the same for at least half a century. As I think of him and his own skills, his name is particularly apt for the rise and fall of civilizations and the briefness of their hometown builders, who erect the pillars and posts of every society, and are so honored for their trade that the son of a prominent deity is claimed to have been a carpenter. Jim's predecessors are to be seen in ancient reliefs and paintings, and more recently in photographs dating back a century and more. Always building, regardless of the weathering away of however many Sumers, Jerichos, Troys, Romes, Angkor Wats, Anasazi Pueblos. This is Michael McCusker.